This is Morning Edition from NPR News. Good morning. I'm Renee Montagne.
And I'm Ari Shapiro. U.S. intelligence agencies have joined the debate over climate change and its possible effects. A classified assessment delivered to Congress earlier this month concluded that rising global temperatures would indirectly present a security threat to the United States. This is the first time the U.S. intelligence community has weighed in on the climate change issue, and joining us now to discuss the report is NPR's intelligence correspondent Tom Gelton. Good morning.
Good morning, Ari.
Well, we've heard a lot about climate change generally, but explain the connection here with national security.
Well, this would be an indirect connection, Ari. The intelligence analysts who produced this report emphasized that the United States is probably capable of handling any adverse impacts of global warming. In fact, in some ways, the United States could even benefit longer growing seasons for farmers in the upper Midwest, for example. But what happens around the world affects us. Take a country like Bangladesh. A big portion of the population there lives along the coastline, and an increase in the sea level could drive millions from their homes. Where would they go? Probably to India, already overcrowded, lots of political tensions. These would be climate refugees, something the world hasn't seen before, and who knows how it could further destabilize a region. So at some point, a scenario like this does become an international problem for the U.S. as well.
Particularly if people are fleeing to India, which is a nuclear superpower.
Precisely.
Well, this came up at a congressional hearing yesterday. How did members of Congress respond?
Guess what, Ari? In a very political way.
You don't say.
You had Tom Finger, chairman of the National Intelligence Council, trying his best to be very neutral, very nonpartisan, but Democrats and Republicans alike were determined to use that hearing and the report to their own political advantage. Democrats liked hearing that climate change could jeopardize U.S. national security because it was a way to strengthen their argument in favor of various government programs to deal with climate change and boost alternative energy development. Several Republicans, meanwhile, agreed that climate change would create national security problems if there actually is global warming underway. But they questioned whether a national intelligence report had to be written to more or less state the obvious, in their words. Much of the material that underlay this intelligence report, of course, it's available to anyone with access to the internet. Listen here to what Pete Hoekstra of Michigan had to say.
I would apologize for Congress asking you to do this work in the first place. There are a lot more pressing issues out there for the intelligence community to be focused on right now that would help keep America safe and that would actually enable the intelligence community to do what I think we're spending $40 billion a year on, and it's not speculating on open source information.
Again, that's Congressman Pete Hoekstra of Michigan, the ranking Republican on the House Intelligence Committee.
Well, can you answer Congressman Hoekstra's question for us? Why was this assigned to the intelligence committee?
It was actually the initiative of a few Democrats who wanted the argument laid out. They've been pushing for this report for a long time. But it is important to say that the intelligence community does analyses like this all the time. Analysts like to know the social, economic, political, and even climatological context in which events are happening. They like to spin out different scenarios of what might happen. And the other thing is that intelligence analysts often focus on what they call open source materials, what Hoekstra referred to there. In fact, there's a growing feeling in the intelligence community that analysts should make more use of what's available publicly so they don't have to employ vast resources collecting information secretly.
If the information was available publicly, why was the final report classified?
That's a really good question. It's actually classified at just about the lowest level of secrecy. It's called confidential. And as I understand it, it's basically for diplomatic reasons. The intelligence agencies in that report make some really harsh comments about the competence of particular governments to deal with the climate change challenge. And I guess they didn't want those countries named publicly.
Thanks, NPR's Tom Gelton.
Thank you.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Michelle Norris.
And I'm Robert Siegel. After nearly two decades, ExxonMobil will finally have to pay punitive damages for the Valdez oil spill. But in a victory for the company, the Supreme Court slashed those damages to just over $500 million. That's a small fraction of what the plaintiffs, including thousands of fishermen, had hoped for. NPR's Frank Langford reports.
In March 1989, the Exxon Valdez struck a reef off the coast of Alaska. The captain, Joseph Hazelwood, had been drinking, and at the time of the accident, he wasn't even on the bridge. After he returned, he described what happened over the radio.
It's Valdez, Doc. We should be on your radar there. We've fetched up on the ground.
Actually, a lot of oil, almost 11 million gallons worth. It was the worst spill on record in North America. The herring fishery in Prince William Sound has never recovered. A lower court told the company to pay $2.5 billion as punishment. But today, the Supreme Court knocked that number down dramatically. Concerned about oversized damage awards, the court said a company shouldn't pay more in punitive damages than it's already paid in compensatory damages. The plaintiffs, which included thousands of fishermen, were naturally disappointed. David Frederick filed a friend of the court brief for the state of Alaska.
For the people who were harmed, they will recover approximately $15,000 apiece, which is a pittance compared to the devastation the oil spill wreaked on their lives.
Frederick also says the damage amount is too small to serve as a deterrent. Given the high price of oil, $500 million won't dent a company like Exxon.
This decision is tantamount to barely a week's profits. That doesn't deter the company from engaging in the kind of recklessness that the jury found and which the court upheld.
Andy Fry says that's nonsense. He filed a brief for the American Petroleum Institute, an industry group. Fry points out that Exxon has already paid more than $3 billion in cleanup, penalties, and compensation.
When you look at all the consequences that they already suffered and all the money that they already paid, making them pay more money is not likely to make them or other oil companies significantly better behaved than they otherwise would be.
While the case focused on Exxon, today's decision could have implications well beyond the company. Amy Wildermuth represents an association of fishermen along the Pacific coast. She didn't like the ruling. The way she sees it, the justices were sending a message about what they see as excessive awards.
I think the court thought, here's an opportunity for us to make a statement, you know, that these punitive damages are sort of running off the rails and we need to rein them back in.
And if that message resonates, it's good news for business. Amar Sarwal is general litigation counsel for the U.S. Chamber of Commerce. He says companies see punitive damages as a dangerous wild card.
When a business looks at a prospective jury award, there's a sense of fear because what's constraining that jury from driving it out of business?
Today's ruling came under federal maritime law, a small corner of the legal world. But lawyers on both sides of the case expect it will be cited soon in others. Frank Langfitt, NPR News, Washington.
The Florida Everglades, you've heard of them. Lots of crocodiles live there, endangered wetlands. Well, environmentalists have been sounding the alarm for years, saying these wetlands have to be restored in order to revive fragile ecosystems and increase scarce fresh water supplies. The U.S. federal government tried to kickstart the restoration in 2000, but it never really panned out. Now the state of Florida is taking things into its own hands. Earlier this week, Florida's Republican Governor Charlie Crist announced a plan to buy up 187,000 acres of former Everglades wetlands from a sugarcane producer in order to restore the lands. Advocates say this plan is the largest restoration project in U.S. history. To explain what's so special about the Everglades and what this project hopes to accomplish, we've enlisted the help of Nick Aumann. He's an aquatic ecologist, scientist with Everglades National Park, and he's been working with water in Florida for more than 17 years. Hey, Nick, thanks for joining us.
Good morning.
So we're going to talk about the deal with the sugar producer and the sale of that property in a minute. But first, I want to talk a little bit about the Everglades for people who've never visited Florida or who aren't into environmental science. Explain why it's so important or why so many advocates have been pushing for so long to restore them.
Oh, sure. I guess I'd start that by saying there's really only one Everglades in the world. It's it's this beautiful, large, 1.4 million acre subtropical wilderness down here at the tip of Florida. It's certainly the only such wilderness in Florida, and organizations across the world have recognized it as an international treasure as well. It's been given a number of international designations, and I think people from around the world recognize it for what it is. And in addition just to being the Everglades, it's also, in terms of just being wetlands, is an important contributor to, you know, why wetlands are important for us as human beings.
Well, let's talk a little bit about that. So clearly, these so many tourists go there every year, and it's regarded as such a treasure. But what difference does it make in how we live our lives? What difference does it make that we keep these wetlands around?
Well, like many important natural ecosystems, wetlands provide what we call ecological services that are important for human beings. They're very important features in any landscape, but, you know, I guess one of the first things that comes to mind is their primary habitat for hundreds of species of waterfowl, other birds, fish, mammals, plants. And wetlands also are what I call filters. They filter water that sometimes is running off from agricultural and urban areas, helping to remove pollutants. And that water, it may end up back in our drinking water tap, so that's really important. They also act like giant sponges, and they slow the flow of surface water and reduce the impact of flooding. In fact, a lot of people believe that the recent flooding in the upper Mississippi would have been a lot less had we not destroyed so many of the floodplain wetlands that were part of that natural system. Your wetlands prevent soil erosion, and I guess more recently, a lot of interest has been paid to global warming and climate change. And like any plants, wetlands that contain plants can remove and store greenhouse gases.
So the federal government clearly thought that this was something important to pursue. In the year 2000, they passed something called the Comprehensive Everglades Restoration Plan. How did that work out?
Well, that plan was the first time the Corps of Engineers and other agencies took a hard look at this big plumbing system we have here in South Florida that provides water supply and flood control to, you know, 6 or 7 million people right at the southern end of Florida here. And that was developed in the, it was authorized by Congress in 1948, developed over the next 30 years, but in the turn caused a lot of ecological damage. And this CERP, the CERP, the plan that you just referenced, was a plan and is still a plan to go and look to see what can be done to modify that big plumbing system to provide water for the environment, yet still ensure flood protection and water supply.
So
it was authorized in 2000, and it's been underway now for 9 years or so.
So now the state of Florida has stepped in to kind of speed up this process. They're going to buy up all of this land, thousands of acres from a sugar plantation. How is this plan being received?
I think people are very excited about it. It was certainly a surprise to a lot of people. It was one of the best-kept secrets during the months that apparently was under negotiation. So it was received, I think, first with surprise and then with a lot of excitement. For those not familiar with the geography down here, of Lake Okeechobee, which we call the liquid heart of South Florida, then just south of that is a 700,000-acre Everglades agricultural area, which is mostly sugarcane, but also other winter vegetables. And then south of that is the remnant Everglades, and further south is Everglades National Park. So this land is being purchased upstream of what we're trying to protect and restore. And I guess one of the reasons we have a lot of excitement about this is this land being back into public ownership eventually gives us a lot more options in terms of restoration.
And what's the timeline finally on this, Nick? For 6 years, the sugar producer gets to keep producing sugar on that land, so the state doesn't get to take it over for 6 years. How long will it take before you start seeing some real resurgence of those wetlands?
Well, if we look back to the last major land purchase anywhere like this in 1999, I believe, or 2000, the federal government acquired about 50,000 acres from agricultural interest, and it took probably, all said, about 10 years, 9 or 10 years, before some of those projects really are underway. So it does take a long time for a deal of this magnitude to fall into place, for the details to be worked out, and especially it looks like from what we're hearing is that in order to realize some of these restoration benefits, land swaps may have to be conducted with other landowners.
And this is a good first step in that direction. Nick Allman is a scientist at Everglades National Park. He's the head of the Water Quality and Everglades Program Team. Hey, Nick, thanks very much for helping us out today. We appreciate it.
Thank you very much.
Coming up on the show, after I enjoy this delicious Fresca, why the FCC might crack down on product placement.
Fresca, the only diet grapefruit carbonated beverage I know.
No, Hansen's actually had. Oh, but that wasn't diet. Fresca is best.
Diet carbonated.
Delicious.
Grapefruit.
This is the BPP from NPR News.
The country's largest cane sugar producer is going out of business and selling its land to the state of Florida for $1.75 billion. The United States Sugar Corporation owns nearly 300 square miles in the Everglades. Florida says the land will be used to help restore the wetlands. Environmental groups are thrilled, and the American sugar industry is trying to figure out how the deal will impact its business. NPR's Kurt Nickisch reports.
Florida Governor Charlie Crist is calling this landmark deal the best gift ever for conserving the fragile Everglades. The state will get over 300 square miles of wetlands, a linchpin in the ecosystem, in what amounts to Florida's biggest land acquisition. U.S. Sugar Corporation CEO Robert Bucher will hand over the land and everything on it.
The railroad, the tractors, it includes the half-eaten pastrami sandwich in the refrigerator.
While environmentalists are praising this wholesale deal, Bucher says it came down to a generous price for company shareholders. For employees, it's bittersweet. Still, they own 30% of the company's stock and also get up to 2 years of severance. Bucher says the agreement has nothing to do with the state of the sugar industry, which he says is great.
Consumption of sweeteners going up, sugar prices at a historic high. We're almost sold out for next year.
And that's exactly why the buyout of the nation's largest sugarcane producer is sending shockwaves through the domestic industry.
Because a resounding, huh?
David Berg is president of American Crystal Sugar Company in Minnesota.
That's a quite dramatic change in direction. I understand their business, I think, reasonably well, but I did not see this coming. I'll be completely honest about it.
Many domestic producers like Berg think losing the company that produces almost a tenth of the nation's sugar crop will be a sour pill to swallow. Growers all over the country rely on their collective political clout to set domestic sugar prices so that low-cost countries can't undercut them. The more states, the more senators there are to protect their market through government policy. U.S. sugar in Florida will basically be out of the picture in 5 years when Congress revises its regulations. Minnesota producer David Berg likes the current prices, but says it was a challenge to get favorable policy through Congress.
And I'm sure we'll be working at doing the same thing 5 years from now. I wish that we had United States Sugar working with us on that.
The U.S. still consumes more sugar than it produces, so now the country will have to import more. Luther Marquardt heads the American Sugar Beet Growers Association.
This is a vital ingredient in the nation's food supply, and you do not want to turn that over in a great portion to foreign suppliers. Then you're going to end up being dependent, as we are, on foreign oil.
For now, though, American sugar producers are just coming to terms with the reality that one of their signature members is signing off. Florida's huge land preservation deal is scheduled to be complete in 6 years, giving the rest of American sugar growers time to sort out how to preserve themselves. Kurt Nickisch, NPR News.
Now, an unusual congressional committee briefing today about global climate change and how it could affect U.S. national security. Included was a warning. Drought and crop failures could trigger major population movements and lead to political instability. The predictions themselves, drawn from a recent classified assessment, generated little debate at the hearing. Members of Congress did quarrel over whether the report was necessary. NPR's Tom Jelton reports.
The report was the collective work of the country's 16 intelligence agencies, from the CIA to the Energy Department's Intel Unit, all overseen by the National Intelligence Council. The agencies were responding to a congressional request to assess the possible impact of global warming. Tom Finger, the council chairman, said it was an unusual assignment for agencies more accustomed to tracking the activities of other governments.
Climate change is an issue on which intelligence, covertly, clandestinely acquired information, is not very helpful. We can't steal Mother Nature's intentions.
Finger warned that the uncertainties surrounding climate predictions and how people will respond to them meant the agencies had only low to moderate confidence in their assessment. Still, he was willing to stand behind a bottom line.
We judge that global climate change will have wide-ranging implications for U.S. national security interest over the next 20 years.
Global warming and severe climate changes, he said, could lead to crop failures, water scarcity, or flooding in vulnerable areas. Countries already endangered by poverty and ineffective government could be destabilized. The intelligence assessment warns of major population shifts as people seek better living conditions. Finger presented the assessment to a joint hearing of the House Intelligence Committee and the Select Committee on Energy Independence and Global Warming. He tried hard to be neutral and avoided any judgment on the science underlying climate change predictions or on possible policies to counteract global warming. But it was a congressional hearing, and members from both parties were anxious to pursue their own political agendas. Democrat Jay Inslee of Washington brought along charts to show how little the U.S. government is spending these days on alternative energy research and development.
We're spending 55 times more money fighting a war in Iraq than we are trying to figure out a way to stop climate change and developing a clean energy future for the country.
Some Republicans use the hearing to once again show skepticism about whether global warming is real. Peter Hoekstra of Michigan, the ranking Republican on the Intelligence Committee, questioned whether U.S. intelligence agencies should even worry about the impact of climate change.
I would apologize for Congress asking you to do this work in the first place. There are a lot more pressing issues out there for the intelligence community to be focused on right now. It was a waste of time, a waste of resources for the intelligence community to be focused on this issue versus other folks in the government.
Hoekstra said the intelligence report was no more than speculation based on information readily available from open sources. But Finger, in defending his report, says the intelligence community provides a level of analysis not found in other agencies, and he said whether the report was based on open or secret sources was irrelevant.
Information is information. Knowledge is knowledge. That how we get it and so forth is less important than does it inform our judgments.
Though the information came from open sources, the assessment itself was classified. Finger said the U.S. government needs to work with other countries to solve climate change problems. He highlighted a series of policy questions that would be difficult to discuss openly.
Which governments we consider to be too incompetent to manage the problem? Do we direct money to the most competent or the most incompetent? There are many, many policy decisions that could be informed by this report, stigmatizing in some way the potential partners by the judgments that we make about them, and it strikes us as the wrong way to go about it.
Committee Democrats and Republicans alike were not convinced by that argument. They said they would ask the Director of National Intelligence to declassify the report. Tom Gelton, NPR News, Washington.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Robert Siegel.
And I'm Michelle Norris. In Florida, officials announced the biggest land conservation deal in the state's history today. The U.S. Sugar Company has agreed to sell all of its holdings to the state for $1,750,000,000. The deal is a major boost for efforts to restore the Everglades. From West Palm Beach, NPR's Greg Allen reports.
The agreement involves 187,000 acres of land, nearly 300 square miles, south of Lake Okeechobee in an area that forms the headwaters of the Everglades. Sometimes called the River of Grass, the Everglades used to be an ecosystem where a sheet of water flowed continuously south from Okeechobee to Florida Bay. Time, flood control, development, and agriculture have reduced that flow to a trickle, endangering a unique ecosystem that's home to alligators, crocodiles, and the Florida panther. Florida Governor Charlie Crist announced the deal at a wildlife refuge not far from sugarcane fields that soon will be returned to wetlands.
I can envision no better gift to the Everglades, the people of Florida, and the people of America as well as our planet than to place in public ownership this missing link that represents the key to true restoration.
Nearly 9 years ago, the federal government developed a new plan for restoring the Everglades. But it didn't deal with a key part of the Everglades problem, the hundreds of thousands of acres used for sugar production, huge plantations that release nutrients and pollutants into the Everglades ecosystem. The announcement that one of the state's biggest sugar companies, one that had farmed the area for nearly 80 years, was now ready to sell out, caught nearly everyone by surprise. U.S. Sugar CEO Robert Bucher denied the company's economic health was a factor in the decision to sell, saying sugar prices are at an all-time high. But he said he still has mixed feelings.
On one hand, I'm sobered and not a little bit saddened by the prospect and transition that lies before us. On the other hand, I'm excited by what we're doing today.
U.S. Sugar is a privately held company which turned down an offer last year to sell for a reported $575 million. Florida's offer is nearly triple that. The money comes from cash and bond holdings Florida set aside for Everglades restoration. But while it may be a good deal for U.S. Sugar, environmental groups say it may be an even better deal for the Everglades. The Sierra Club's Jonathan Ullman says this will now make it possible to restore the natural flow of the Everglades, something that hadn't seemed possible before.
The alternative to supplying the water would have been to build these deep wells, and that would have come out to many billions, and they didn't even know if that was going to work. So this is really the best option.
At today's announcement, while environmental groups, federal and state officials, and U.S. Sugar celebrated the deal, there were a few dissenting voices. They're the people dependent on sugar for their livelihood. People like Artis Hammack, whose family has sold sugarcane to U.S. Sugar since the beginning. Her reaction?
Devastated. Because we're U.S. Sugar's friend. Our family farm has never sold to anyone else. We grew up with them. My husband's uncle pioneered with them. Hopefully friends will continue to take care of friends.
Under an agreement signed today, U.S. Sugar will keep farming and refining sugar at its South Florida plant for the next 6 years. CEO Robert Bucher says that will help ease the transition for the company, its suppliers, and its nearly 1,900 employees. Greg Allen, NPR News, West Palm Beach.